Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here, The Tom Woods Show.
Hey, everybody, welcome to The Tom Woods Show, episode 2487. I'm delighted to be joined once again by Sheldon Richman. If you've been around our little world for any length of time, you surely have heard of or come across old Sheldon Richman, perhaps back from his days editing The Freeman, or perhaps even before that at the Future Freedom Foundation. Were you there?
After Fee, yes.
After Fee, and then author of more books than I can count. I have your Palestine book here on my shelf, but it's too far away for me to read the title. What is it?
It's only six books, so lots of people have written a lot more books than you have.
Well, but all the same, though, you do have a topical one on Palestine,
yes.
And I can't remember the name of it. It's got Palestine in the title.
Coming to Palestine.
Right there in the back, all I had to do was look in the background of the image I'm looking at. But Sheldon is also executive editor over at the Libertarian Institute, libertarianinstitute.org, with our friend Scott Horton. And I want to talk today about what's going on the campuses and the matter of Gaza and all that. So Sheldon, welcome back.
And a great pleasure to be back, because the couple of times I've been on your show have been very pleasurable.
Thank you. Likewise. Well, first of all, let's acknowledge something. We're recording this 3 days ahead of time, which is safe enough when you're doing a 100-year retrospective on the life of Vladimir Lenin, but not so safe when you have very quickly moving events like we have right now. So as I was saying to Sheldon before, if they violently suppress all these demonstrations between now and then, we didn't know that at the time we recorded this, but we're going to be speaking about broader issues that apply no matter what day you're hearing about this. So let's start. I was in New York last week because I was supposed to be doing a debate on COVID policy. And while we were there, I thought, well, you know what? Let's head up to my old stomping ground and see if I can take a peek for myself and see what's going on the Columbia campus. But I had a feeling I wouldn't be allowed in. And in fact, they had chained up all the entrances except two, where they had security guards demanding student, staff, or faculty IDs to get onto the campus. And my lame old alumni ID was simply not recognized. And I thought, well, that's a caveat they didn't tell me about when they handed it to me, that someday they'd prohibit me from entering. But we still were able to peek through the bars of the, I mean, this is our society now, peeking through bars to see what's going on. But as we got there, there were people handing out flyers outside the campus. We saw somebody holding a sign saying New York stands with Israel. And then we came across a group of anti-Zionist Jews who were chanting, a Zionist is not a Jew, a Jew is not a Zionist. And I thought, well, we're in the right place anyway. We know that for sure. So, Sheldon, what is your impression of this whole student movement, first of all?
Well, the people that are doing these encampments, the demonstrations in favor of, number one, stopping the onslaught, the slaughter that's going on daily and has been going on for 6 to 7 months. Whether it's going to be effective or not, I'm somewhat doubtful, but that's not their fault. I'm glad they're trying to do something to bring attention to the horrible stuff going on. And they're aligned issues, disinvestment of their universities, the fact that they want to raise that to their administrations, do it, you know, please do it. They seem very well behaved. I mean, I've been watching tons of video, which includes local news coverage, national, you know, the national mainstream news coverage, CBS, et cetera, the various alternative medias on all sides. I try to watch as much as I can every day on YouTube and other sources. It seems clean and well-behaved. It doesn't look like, you know, a homeless encampment in San Francisco, you know, where you have, you know, litter all over the place and people are doing, you know, it's the streets sound pretty bad in parts of like the Tenderloin District in San Francisco. It's nothing like that. It looks entirely clean and neat. Those little tents seem fine. They're serving meals. So I give them my blessing for what it's worth. On the other side, I can't think of a more cynical episode that's been going on than this. And the reason I say that is because I'm a person who begins assuming good faith on the part of people I disagree with and who are going to disagree with me. I believe in the principle of charity, which means you give them, you know, put their point of view in the best light you can. Ask yourself, how do they see it? Assuming they're sincere, which is my first assumption. Now, how do they see it? That to them, it appears plausible and honorable and sincere. So that's what I typically ask myself. In this case, I cannot do that. I mean, I tried it for a few minutes, but it's so thin. I mean, that's giving it too much credit. When you say thin, that means there's some thickness. It might be very slight. It's not thick enough to be thin. And that, what I'm referring to is the portrayal of the people I described before, the people I'll call the good people, just trying to attempt to describe them or attempting to describe them as anti-Semitic and that these are pro-Hamas anti-Semitic demonstrations. You hear this on the mainstream media and all the commentators. You even hear this, it's happening in England. I mean, I used to follow Spiked online, the magazine Spiked. Every day, it's like the scourge of elite anti-Semitism at these pro-Hamas rallies and the street rallies too, not just the campus rallies. But I don't believe that anybody who says that really believes it himself or herself. I think they know they're being dishonest. And I hate to say that. I don't say that about people. Maybe there's some exceptions. It's ridiculous. First of all, there's Jews all through the demonstrations. It's on their T-shirts. It's on their signs. Jews against Zionism. Jewish Voice for Peace. Not in my name. Jews for a ceasefire. Jews for freedom in Palestine. You mean to tell me, what are those? Unconscious? Are they robots? Are they dummies? Mannequins that the anti-Semites have set up? It doesn't make any sense with a moment's examination.
I saw a video of somebody who, if I'm getting the story right, has since actually been expelled. It may have been a Columbia student, it's all very vague in my mind, in which he was saying, look, if you possess the ideology of Zionism, then yes, you should die because your ideas lead to suffering and death.
I saw that video.
Right. And so I think it's things like that that are making people say, ah, you see, the student movement is full of anti-Semitism. The thing is, I don't fall for that because I saw how they did that at Ron Paul rallies. They'd pick out the one nut who had nothing to do with us, who was spouting all kinds of crazy nonsense that none of us agreed with, and that person would be elevated and featured on the TV news. Whereas we had more articulate people than have ever been assembled in one place together, any of whom would have been happy to answer media questions, who remained anonymous the whole time.
That's right. I mean, when you look at, first of all, how isolated those incidents are, like that one kid, he was a pretty young kid, who was saying, for those, he didn't say, if you're a Jew. He said, if you're a Zionist. Now, maybe he equates them, and so maybe he's an anti-Semite. I don't know who he is. Assume he's an anti-Semite. Assume the worst. He said, you know, you don't deserve to be comfortable, and then he followed it up with, you don't deserve to live. And I guess he's been expelled. He isn't disciplined. But those kinds of things are, you know, to say they're isolated is to overstate it. You know, you can count it on half of a hand, incidents like that. And some cases where incidents that seem to be something like that, not a video, but actually somebody in person on a campus, has been debunked as false flag. And speaking of false flag, no pun intended, the woman who got stabbed in the eye with a flag pole, you know, that fell apart. It's ridiculous. Look at the video online. She gets stabbed in the eye with a flag pole. Maybe a flag brushed her face as somebody was walking by. Clearly, it wasn't like an aggressive, hostile action by the person, even if he accidentally, if the flag accidentally brushed her, or maybe even the stick, it wasn't a big pole. It was like a, you know, handheld flag stick. You know, if it touched her, you know, stabbing, you think of, you know, Psycho, right? In the bathtub. Yeah. And then that got all over the media, right? Girl stabbed by pro-Palestine anti-Semitic demonstrator. It's ridiculous. And so you can count maybe three incidents, and some of those three have fallen apart even. So even if it's a real incident like this person you described, it's hardly typical of the thousands of students, especially when you have, you know, the question I ask is, I'm a student of British detective police dramas. I watch them all the time. I'm sure some people, my kids would say, I watch them too much. I really love them. They know how to do their crime shows. They're very good at it. I think I'm learning to think like a detective. So when you don't have CCTV, you don't have video, right, of an alleged crime, an alleged perpetrator, and you don't have eyewitness testimony, you got to at least think about motive. Okay, why would so-and-so do such and such? Well, I say, why would all those non-Jewish demonstrators alienate all those Jewish demonstrators that they're encamped with 24 hours a day, sharing meals, sharing religious services? There have been outdoor seders, which is the ritual Passover dinner, the first two nights, and also Sabbath services, where it's been ecumenical, and some Muslim services, like on Fridays, it's been ecumenical. People like sitting in on each other's religious ceremonies. You mean to tell me this is essentially a string of anti-Semitic demonstrations? Dana Bash, you know, that very wise lady on CNN called it, it's tapping into an undercurrent of anti-Semitism. That is a joke. I don't believe anybody believes that. I think it's cynical. It's a way to take people's minds off what's happening in Gaza. And anti-Semitism is always the red herring used to divert attention from anti-Zionism, which is an entirely reasonable thing. They're Jewish anti-Zionism is as old as Jewish Zionism. And I can talk a little bit about the history if you're interested in that. It's as old as Zionism itself. That's my stone. Those people, those early critics of Herzl and his successors and then their successors, I always reach back saying, remember what they said and what would they be saying today? I think I know. It wouldn't be favorable to Israel, Netanyahu, Biden, etc.
Well, I do want to get back to that in a minute. In fact, I'm going to make a quick note of that because I'm interested in that subject as well. But while we're on this subject, I want to ask you about what do you think about these claims that we've been hearing that Jewish students aren't safe on campus, Jewish faculty aren't safe on campus. I know at Columbia, I heard at least one faculty member say, look, I'm Jewish and not for one second am I concerned about my safety. This is all silly. Do you think, honestly, that's just all drama queening?
I think it is. I mean, I think I kind of covered it in my opening remarks. But specifically, you know, when that rabbi at Columbia last week, he instant messaged a lot of, I guess he maintains some kind of list of Jewish students and said, don't come into class, it's not safe. What did the Hillel House say at Columbia? We're open. And I didn't hear them say, we're not going to be cowed. In other words, they weren't saying, oh yeah, there's a reason to be afraid, but darn it, we're staying. It was more like, hey, we're not, there's no reason to close. So you can go on YouTube and find Jewish students and Jewish faculty at all these campuses, and this is spreading like wildfire, saying, what are they talking about? I'm going to class, I'm walking through the campus. And like I said, if this demonstration itself is filled with Jewish students holding signs that say, or wearing t-shirts, not in my name, Jewish voice for peace, Jews for ceasefire, is that credible? That's why I said it's so cynical. It's not even a little bit credible after you look into it a bit, you know, 5 minutes.
I've jotted down a bunch of things that I want to pick your brain on. But but while we're, you know, you mentioned the subject of the history of Zionism, and that it's not a matter of Zionism develops and everybody instantly sees the attraction of it, that in fact, there were quite profound religious objections to it. And so maybe rather than me share what I know about that, maybe you can take a minute to explain that, because we do still see here and there scattered remnants of that point of view. For example, as I said, I saw a bunch of people outside Columbia spreading that exact idea.
Well, to make a personal point of it, and I don't like to play cards, you know how people play cards, identity cards. I am a dropout from the Jewish religion. Okay, I don't hold the beliefs and I don't engage in the practices. So out of respect for the people that do, I don't regard myself part of the religion. I think it's disrespectful for the people that take it very seriously and practice it. And I don't, don't criticize them. I grew up in Philadelphia, middle class Jewish neighborhood. My parents were Republicans, but the neighborhood was heavily Democrat. And I grew up with the typical American Jewish view of Israel, which means very Zionist, but not in the sense of, oh, we're going to move there someday. My parents had no interest in moving there. They'd go visit maybe, but move there? No, they loved the United States. So they weren't those sorts of Zionists. There's an old joke that a Zionist is a Jew who raises money from another Jew to send a third Jew to Israel. That's an old joke. But growing up, I was already in my teens because it was around 1967. I was born in late 1949, so you can put a timeline on this. I heard one dissenting voice, anti-Zionist voice, and it was my paternal Orthodox Jewish grandfather, Sam Richmond, my father's father. My parents were devout pro-Israel people, gave money. We used to take cans around to raise money to plant trees. Little did I know, those trees were being planted on stolen land. But my grandfather, only on one occasion, as he put it, blamed the Jews for the trouble in Israel-Palestine. And my mother couldn't believe it. And I can't believe I didn't ask any questions. I was just listening. I can't believe I was old enough to say more. I don't know why I didn't do it. If I could go back in time, he'd be the guy I'd visit and say, sorry, I missed that opportunity. Tell me. My mother would say, what are you talking about? It's a tiny little sliver of land. They're in a sea of hostile Arabs. I want to drive them into the sea. You know, they made the desert bloom. And he'd say, you should go and see it, she'd say. And he'd say, I wouldn't set foot in that place. And in the Seder, which is the Passover ritual dinner, the first two nights, there's a line where you say, because you're reading the book, which is like sort of like a digest of the book of Exodus. You know, it's like a stripped down story because you're reading it at a dinner. So it's not the whole thing. And there's a line where you say, next year in Jerusalem, my grandfather every year, I remember this very well, would get to that line and say, next year in Philadelphia. We were in Philadelphia. In other words, I'm not going anywhere. So I said that Jewish anti-Zionism is as old as Jewish Zionism. Herzl had critics. When Herzl wanted to hold the first Zionist Congress in Munich, 1896, I believe, or 8. I think he starts, he writes his book in 96, so 98 might have been the first Congress of these, World Jewish Organization. The rabbis all ganged up on him and said, not in our city. In fact, I think they even turned to the city administration to say, keep them out. Not a libertarian thing, but that's a different story. So that's why they met in Basel, however you pronounce it, in Switzerland. They went to Basel. The rabbis wouldn't let them go to Munich. So you had two branches of Judaism that were dead set against Zionism. And it took a while. They eventually weakened for the most part. There are lots of exceptions. But what I'm going to describe is not true today, unfortunately. The Orthodox were against it on the grounds that who died and made Herzl and David Ben-Gurion the Messiah? We're supposed to wait for the Messiah. We were expelled. I'm not saying this is historically accurate, but they believe this very devoutly. We were expelled for our sins from Judea, by God, because we didn't keep the commandments in the Torah. That's the scroll. That's the five books and the other additional books. And in fact, the prophets also said the diaspora should live peacefully in whatever countries they end up in. I mean, you have some of the prophets saying, become good citizens of where you're living. I mean, keep your religion, but be peaceful, you know, peaceful citizens of that place. The idea was the Messiah someday will come and then lead us back. It wasn't a political movement. It would have been just a spiritual religious movement. They didn't talk about politics. So that was the Orthodox criticism. The Reform criticism, Reform Judaism, which was kind of the looser, more modern, they were trying to modernize the other side, was a belief that the modern world, the laws of Moses and the kingdom of Israel, that's back in biblical times when kind of everybody was related, right? They're all descendants from Jacob back then. And so they said, this is a different world now. We Reformed Jews have been sent throughout the world to bring the word to everybody and to live in our societies. And the ones in America said, we love America. Jews have full rights here. Sure, there was private prejudice and stuff like that, which they were fighting. But they were citizens, and they loved the United States. They would say things like, you know, America is our Palestine or our promised land. They loved it, and the Brits would say the same thing. So the Herzl types and his descendants, his you know, successors, were getting it from both sides. And so that's really the story. They were dead against it. The Orthodox and the Reform both warned that since it's a secular movement, it wasn't a religious movement. Herzl was secular. He had a Christmas tree. In fact, his first plan to solve the Jewish question, as he called it, in Austria, where he lived in the Austro-Hungarian Empire, was to approach the Catholic Church and said, what if we just all converted to Catholicism? Couldn't we then live peacefully here? And the church apparently didn't want to hear about it. So then he went to plan B. Okay, we need our own state. We have to give up living in Europe. But the first plan was convert. And so it wasn't even a religious movement. They ended up having to recast Jews as not a religion. Judaism is not a religion, but as an ethnicity, a blood group, a race, all of which is nonsense. When I say only, I don't mean to demean it. It's only a religion. There's no Jewish blood, no Jewish DNA. It's not a race. It's all nonsense. But except since they were atheists and seculars, what else do you have your hat? If you rule out all religion, what do you hang your hat on if you want to form a people? You got to start talking about blood and race and stuff like that. And so both Reform and Orthodox said, this will destroy the religion. It's a counterfeit religion. They're hijacking our religion. You can find Orthodox on YouTube who talk this way. They anti-Zionist Orthodox. Very interesting stuff. it will destroy the religion because at the center is God and Torah, right? God and the commandments, God and the law. And Zionism will replace that with the state. There's a very libertarian message there too, right? It's idolatry. As Naomi Klein, who's somebody I'm not really a fan of, but she gets this right. Israel is the golden calf. That's a very good way to sum it up. And that sums up the Jewish criticism of Zionism. So that's that story there.
But today, here's what I'm curious about. Today, if I were to speak to most people in either of the two groups you just mentioned, they would look at the anti-Zionist Jews I ran into at Columbia as crazy and unreasonable and wildly out of the mainstream. So what I'm curious about is how did that transformation occur that this critique of Zionism from a Jewish standpoint began to fall away? And I wonder if it's in any way analogous to the life of William Lloyd Garrison, who was a pacifist. But then he's faced with the violence of the Civil War. Like, here, I've got it. If I could just agree with this war, I've got something on the other side of it that's going to be great. Was it that the prospect of an Israel made the resistance melt away?
I think the sense that this is a fait accompli or will be, and then, of course, we have to talk about the Nazis. I mean, that's a big thing. You know, there were problems before that, certainly. You know, I take no joy in talking about this. I'm happy to talk about it with you or just about anybody else. My sister and brother won't talk to me about it. So I got to talk about it with other people. The parts of Europe, you know, 19th century and going back, had been very rough for various Jewish communities, not entirely uniformly. I've read books that pointed out that it's wrong to think of it as a sort of a very smooth, you know, history, you're a historian. History is not like very super smooth mashed potatoes. It's extremely lumpy. And so we can't say Europe is a history of nothing but virulent anti-Semitism. It was better and worse in some places at different times, You got to be really careful and do kind of micro. And this is true of all history, I'm sure. I'm not a historian by training, but you are. You need to look carefully at different places. You can't just say, yeah, for hundreds of years, there was this uniform anti-Semitism throughout Europe. That's just not true. But terrible things happened. The pogroms in Russia and Poland in the late 19th century, you know, horrible things. You get killed. Women got raped. People got driven out of their villages. If you've seen Fiddler on the Roof, you know, the scene at the end where they have to leave, you know, that stuff happened. The Pale, you could only live in a certain area. There were some restrictions on what you could do for a living. All those things are absolutely true. And it breaks your heart when you read about it. So on top of all that, then you have the Nazis. Okay, that sounds like a pretty bad history. And it is. You know, Mises has written a lot about the rise of the Nazis. And it's definitely worth reading because it had a lot of causes. It wasn't just one thing. It wasn't just Jewish hatred. There's lots of stuff going on there. So I think that, especially since, after the war, we're now at 1945, and I think for a lot of people, a lot of like formerly anti-Zionist Jews, and there was a little time for it to begin to fade, it was like, with the Nazis, and it's a fait accompli anyway, what are we going to do? It doesn't mean they were wholeheartedly in favor, although some probably turned around, you know, saying with the Nazis, yes, we're wholeheartedly in favor of it. There are Orthodox Jews in Israel who hate the state of Israel. There's a group called the Neturei Karta, which is Hebrew, I guess, for guardians of the city. And they wear Palestinian colors. They wear a keffiyeh in a way that Jews wear the talis, you know, that the prayer shawl that, you know, if you see Jews praying, they wear that. They wear the keffiyeh as that. Their sympathy is completely with the Palestinians because they think, number one, it wasn't a land without a people. That's a lie. And Herzl was told that. You know, there's a story, it may be apocryphal, but one of Herzl's people went to visit Palestine when he decided, Palestine's the place. He had other places in mind at first. But they said, nah, it's got to be Palestine. So he said, Palestine. Land without a people, for people without a land. One of his top aides goes there and wires back or something and says, like you said, the bride is beautiful. Unfortunately, she's married. In other words, there were people there. They knew that immediately. And so, you know, that got smashed. The reform, there's still a remnant of anti-Zionist reform. Let me put it on a plug for the American Council for Judaism, which started up in 1943, so it's kind of late. Rabbi Elmer Berger who wrote lots of good stuff. You can find his stuff in the used bookstores, maybe, or libraries. Very good. I learned a lot from him. I met him once or twice. Wasn't like a close friend or anything. But the group still exists, so they still have a mailing list and members. And a guy by the name of Alan Braunfeld has been their editor, their newsletter editor, for a very long time. He's very knowledgeable about this. He's not from the left. He's a longtime conservative activist, not a crazy Trump-type conservative activist. So it's still alive. Yeah, it's much less than it was because, now, fait accompli, what are you going to do? People aren't going to stay agitated forever. They kind of move on. You can kind of understand.
Let me ask you a couple of devil's advocate style questions because, and by the way, I appreciate all that background because I think most people are unaware of it. And I do think your answer to my question about where did this all go is very convincing. But let's go back to the students on the campuses. And I've seen a number of people, you know, we might say on the right wing, say something like, look, these are kids who, they don't like you either. They hate you too. You being like just a regular American who's not committed to socialist anti-colonialism or something. And so these are people who, during COVID, when their own lives were being taken away, couldn't be bothered to lift a finger, except probably to condemn people for not taking the shots and stuff like that. These people are not your friends, even if they overlap on one thing. How would you answer that?
Well, there's more than a grain of truth there. I get pretty annoyed by some of the, I don't know what you want to call them, radical left critics, who I agree with on the more narrow issue of how Israel has treated the Palestinians from the very start. So that's not my beef with them. I sometimes don't like the attitude of take no prisoners. There's a take no prisoners attitude where you can never acknowledge that, you know, somebody might have said something true on the other side. It's always very grudging. But I agree with you because I keep thinking, well, yeah, they don't want the U.S. to be spending money on Israel or Ukraine, because we know how to spend the money better. In other words, they don't want the taxpayers to keep it, and they don't want the Fed to shut down and the borrowing to stop. They want to spend the money. They're pro-coercion. They just want domestic coercion. Now, they don't want to drop bombs, but they want to push us around domestically for a good cause, of course. So that's always in the back of my mind. And a lot of those people kind of bug me. I also don't like fitting the Palestine-Israel problem into a sort of a larger colonial story. I realize there's overlap, there are some common elements, but I don't just think this is old, you know, what they consider old-fashioned, white supremacist, European imperialism and colonialism, and therefore they want to, and I am very suspicious of the word decolonize. Maybe you've come across this, because it means more than just, yeah, if an outside power is oppressing people in some country over there, they should get out, that's fine. But they want to go further. In their view, they want to rid those societies, these victim societies, and they were victims in a lot of ways, but they want to rid those victim societies of all vestiges of, quote, the West. But you and I know what they mean by that. Markets, division of labor, in other words, free markets. And they're just wrong about that. So I don't like this template they have that they fit over every situation, you know, if they have the least hint that it might work. You know, I think the Palestine-Israel problem is unique in a lot of ways because of the history of Jews in Europe. So I don't think you can just say, this is just white supremacist settler colonialism. And therefore, it's sort of unthinking. It's lazy on the part of these left radicals. I'm not with them all the way. I'm with them on the particular issue and what ought to happen now. Stop the bombing and stop the onslaught and the starvation and stuff like that. But I hope I answered your question. I'm not.
No, you did.
You're right. They wouldn't be able to do us on most other things. Yeah, stopping aid to Ukraine, sending guns and stuff to Ukraine. Yeah, they agree with us on that. And I think they know. They don't like libertarians.
Yeah. Hey, everybody, it's Ol Woods here with a mini interview with our friend Jeff Deist, whose appearances on the Tom Woods Show you all love so much. And we're talking about Monetary Metals, where he works now. And you've heard me talk about this nonstop. So now it's going to be Jeff's turn to talk about it. Jeff, tell me about Monetary Metals. What is the value here?
Well, Tom, remember back in the day when Ron Paul used to ask Ben Bernanke, then chairman of the Federal Reserve, what's gold? What's the purpose of gold? Is it money? Why does the Fed hold it? And of course, he waffled and said it's a historical relic and it's just a precious metal, but it's not. I mean, for more than 5,000 years, gold's been money. There's $13 trillion worth of it out there just sitting around in bank vaults. Why don't we generate some interest from that? Why don't we put it to work as money as a capital asset. That's the idea behind monetary metals.
So what does a person have to do to be part? Do you have to come in there owning your own gold? Do they sell you the gold? How does it work?
Absolutely not. Whether you've got physical metals that you want to ship to us safely, or whether you want to simply send a bank wire or a check, we can convert your money into gold and get you started earning interest right away.
All right, everybody, check it out. monetary-metals.com/woods. I have an account there. I know the people who work there. We all know Jeff Deist. So check it out for yourself. monetary-metals.com/woods. But now let's look at it from a country standpoint, because some people will say, or I've heard people say, I understand your perspective on Israel-Palestine. I understand your outrage at Israeli policy. But the fact is, you as a Westerner would vastly prefer to live in Israel over any of the surrounding countries. And the surrounding countries are generally failed states. And so if you say either we'll give these people their own state, or we'll change Israel around so that it's just a democracy like any other place. And so that is to say, Palestinians could outvote Jewish voters in no time at all, especially given birth rates and stuff. The result would not be just another wonderful state like we have, you know, some of in the West. It would be another one of these failed states. We know that these people produce these kinds of states every single time. So you're just going to destroy the one livable place in this region. That's what I'm hearing people say.
I take that very seriously. Okay, that's not to be laughed at or dismissed like some people on the left. Our leftist allies might do that, which is not to imply I'm a rightist. I'm not. I reject both of those. Yeah, you have to notice that the other... Look, I believe, unlike the multiculturalists on the left, I believe that you can judge other cultures. And other cultures are, of course, not homogeneous. They're not smooth mashed potatoes either. Part of a culture can be good and part of a culture can be bad. It can be very lumpy. And you could say, hey, that's something, I like that practice. Maybe I'll try that. Maybe they discovered something, you know, we don't know about. On the other hand, you could say, I don't want any part of that. Cultures are lots, and I learned a lot from Thomas Sowell reading this stuff. Cultures have many moving parts, and you are allowed to pick and choose and try to bring something in, first of all, to your personal culture, but it might spread because people might say, yeah, that's a good idea, let's try that. So, but you can judge kind of on net or on the whole a given country. I mean, I could name a whole bunch of countries I certainly would not want to live in, absolutely. And sure, by comparison, Israel looks better, especially if you're Jewish. It's not as good if you were Palestinian, because it's a Jewish state, and it is Jewish supremacist. They make no bones about it. They passed that nation state law, what is it, in 2018? And there's a, you know, be careful when you hear people say, but Palestinian Christians and Muslims have full citizenship in Israel. You'll hear that a lot. They vote. They can be in the, they can have a party, they parties. They can be in the parliament, the Knesset. But what they don't tell you is there's not only citizenship in Israel, there's nationality in Israel. And nationality counts more than citizenship. And on the ID card, it used to say not citizenship, but nationality. And what is nationality? Not Israel, Israeli, or some other nation. It's Jew, Arab, Druze, and maybe other. I forget the categories. And while they ended up taking that off the card that you carry around, it's still in the government records. So, yeah, beware when they say, well, but they're citizens. They're citizens. But of course, it's a Jewish state. Doesn't that have any teeth in it? Wouldn't you think the people that run the Jewish state would not want to have an open, free system? I'm no more of a fan of democracy than you are. If there's got to be democracy, and I hope that's not the case, I would want it to be an extremely limited democracy, just like you. In other words, the powers that the people could vote on, or the things that would be so small in number that nobody would even care anyway. So, okay, that'd be fine. But that should not be the test. If you had to live in a Middle Eastern country, which one would you choose? Now, what do you do about it? I make a habit of not giving advice to people over there about what they should do, because I truly don't know. I can understand the concern that Israelis, that Jewish Israelis have if they were to make it a completely secular, open state, either with two states or with one state from the river to the sea. I don't mean that anti-Semitically. What's her name? Elise Stefanik. So don't call me up before a committee. I don't mean it that way, even if you mean it that way. I don't want to pretend here living safely in Little Rock, Arkansas, that I have an easy answer for that. I don't. What I do know is what Israel shouldn't do. I cannot see any excuse for what's been going on since October, well, probably start of the 7th, I was going to say the 8th, but this onslaught, and it's not the first time. How many times has it happened, not on the scale, but in our century, this 21st century? Is this the 5th or 6th time that Israel has laid waste to Gaza in a Norman Finkelstein that keeps the count and keeps the casualty figures? It's happened many times since the year 2001. Then they call it mowing the lawn, the Israeli leaders, because they do it on a regular basis. And there's an embargo. Israel controls the air, the land, and the sea as far as getting in or getting out. It's total control. That's why it's so embarrassing that on the 7th, Hamas people were able to get through that fence in 10 different places or get over the fence with those motorized, whatever they call those, gliders. And I'm not defending what they did on the 7th. Certainly not attacking non-combatants. That's a no-no. You don't attack non-combatants. You don't kill. You don't rape. You don't do any of that stuff, even though a lot of those stories have fallen apart. You know, the baby beheadings. And you know, what they did was bad enough. Did the Israelis really have to embellish and make up stories about systematic rape, that New York Times story, which has fallen apart? That just goes back to the cynicism, I think. I hope I answered your question. I don't have any easy answers about what to do now. The genie's out of the bottle. There's a lot of blood feuds. People are mad at each other for the decades that have passed with people being killed. But I know what shouldn't happen. The Palestinians shouldn't be paying the price for bad Europeans. That's really what happened, right? We were bad Europeans. Yes, bad. And you Palestinians are going to pay the price for it. So move out, move over. The European Jews who suffered at our hands are coming there. And of course, anti-Semites would say, oh, good. They're going to leave Europe and go far away to Middle East? Can I pack your bags? Can I drive you to the airport? How can I help?
Let me ask you one of the big, big questions that people have. We hear all the time that Hamas uses civilians as, quote, human shields, and that meanwhile, the IDF is scrupulously careful to try to avoid civilian casualties whenever possible, but their hands are tied because of these unethical practices of Hamas. What's your thought on that?
That certainly is the standard answer you're going to get. And again, it needs to be looked at seriously. Jeremy R. Hammond, because I think there's another Jeremy Hammond, but he's been publishing, he has his own blog on foreignpolicy.org or something like that. But we've been reprinting them, reposting them at the Libertarian Institute. He has an article with a lot of links directly addressing this idea that Israel is the most moral army in the world. That's a very old saying, right? The IDF is the most moral army in the world. You know, they've done some leafleting. Sometimes they say they do a knock on the roof. I don't know what they do. They drop something on the roof, not a bomb, that's supposed to tell you to get out. But look what they've done. First of all, they were telling everybody, go south, we're going to slam the north. Then they started bombing the south. And of course, Netanyahu, even though Biden's telling them not to, is planning on a full-scale invasion of Rafah in the very south, right at the Egyptian border, because he claims we can't wipe out Hamas unless we do that. He won't wipe it out anyway, but he does say that. So, you know, where's the humanity in that? And where's the humanity in blocking food from getting in and medicine and stuff like that, which they're doing? Not only the army, but even the settlers. You see these stories? You see there's video. There's been stories at The Intercept about it. Crazy Orthodox settlers, most of whom I think were from Brooklyn, New York, who live on settlements in the West Bank, in other words, encroached on Palestinian land, took their land and built settlements, are coming over to the border with or the boundary with Gaza and blocking aid trucks and celebrating and videoing it and, you know, eating, I don't know, cotton candy. I mean, they're having all kinds of fun. They have buses picking up people around the country and then take them there to harass the trucks. The few that are able to get in would have been able to get in. So this is the most moral armed forces in the world. I don't see it. It seems like a very cruel game. Go south, because so therefore we can, you know, murder people in the north without killing civilians. And then as soon as they're south, they start bombing down there, like go north. That doesn't sound like very kind. That doesn't sound like kindness to me. Now, as far as shields and human shields, by the way, the IDF has been caught, and human rights groups have issued reports on this, have been caught using Palestinians as human shields before October 7th in the West Bank and other places, especially the West Bank. So hands are not clean. But you have 2.3 million Palestinians crowded into the Gaza Strip, which is 5 miles wide and 25 miles long. May not be the most dense place in the world, but it's a very dense, unfree place. You know, New York City's pretty dense, but it's relatively free. You can import, you can export, you can bring in goods. You can't do that easily in Gaza. So any group, a resistance group, and you're allowed to resist even under international law, you're allowed to resist an occupation or imprisonment like that. How do they not be near civilians? I mean, so it doesn't mean they're literally strapping babies on their chests and then fighting, shooting, daring somebody to shoot them. You know, we always hear these analogies like, you know, there's somebody in a mall who's about to spray with a machine gun and he's got a baby. You know, libertarians like to argue about these things. Is it moral to shoot even though you know you're going to kill the baby? You know, that is not analogous. It's very different. So I'm trying to answer your question, and I hope I gave some guidance there.
Well, these are hard questions.
Yeah.
I mean, as you say, from our point of view as libertarians, I think we feel like, for the most part, we understand how the world works. So in a great many cases, in effect, there kind of is an answer. There is a right answer. You know, you should get rid of that subsidy. You know, you should get rid of that price control. You should get rid of that monopoly. Once you understand the basic ideas, a lot of questions more or less answer themselves. But this one defies that.
Yeah.
Because as you say, you know, it's like the genie's been let out of the bottle kind of thing. And at this point, it's understandably difficult for both sides to sit and look at the matter dispassionately and say, well, here's the rational solution that everybody, according to game theory, ought to be prepared to accept. And so we're in an unusual situation.
I think of someone on the other side on this kind of issue, namely William Kristol.
Oh,
yeah. Fan of. In fact, Scott pretty much handed him his hat at the Soho Forum a few years ago. I was even shocked at how easy a target he was. I would have been hesitant to go on a stage with William Kristol. I thought he knew much more than he apparently knows. But I heard him say a few years ago, I actually, you know, heard him say it on a video, but it was him. It wasn't just a quote of his. Where, you know, people were saying, you know, this is way before October 7th. He's saying, you know, people are saying the status quo can't last. What do we do? What do we do? What do we do? And he said, yes, it can. The status quo can last. I'm fine with that. That's what he said. And I think Netanyahu, I mean, maybe they'd like to be able to run all the Palestinians out, but no, with public opinion in the U.S., it maybe has some limits. We can't quite do that. But we can put up with what's, you know, we could put up with, now they changed their mind on October 7th because they got really surprised. They certainly did, I'm sure. I'm sure they surprised a lot of Palestinians that they got through that fence and that stuff, which is not to praise the killing of noncombatants. I'll have to repeat that because I know what people will think. Oh, he's justifying terrorism. Some of my family thinks that. I'm not. But I think there is that attitude that what's wrong with the status quo? Why do we have to change anything? I wish I had an answer, but I feel even funny giving any advice to people over there because they live in a dangerous place and I'm perfectly safe. And I'm safe, I believe, even walking on an average American college campus. I think I'm safe, although some people may not think I am.
Yeah, I hear exactly what you're saying because I consider myself a person of goodwill. I've changed my opinion on this subject over the course of my life. I was strongly one side, strongly the other. Now I more or less lean toward what you're saying. But I think to myself, and maybe this goes to what you just said, if I had been born in Israel, let's say in 1972, the year of my birth, let's say I'd been born in Israel, and I have to live with the reality of I would like to have a peaceful, quiet life, the preconceptions in my head would tell me I have to favor a particular approach to the issue. But at the same time, a particularly militaristic type of approach to the situation might give you some kind of short-term tough guy satisfaction, but in the long term, it doesn't seem very promising.
I know, and it breaks my heart because I am a compassionate person like you, and I bear no ill will. I mean, with a few exceptions like Netanyahu and Smotrich and Ben-Gavir and a few other people. But I mean, as far as just the person in the street, look, I have, well, they were my brother's in-laws, so I can't really count them as relations, but they weren't even my in-laws, who, you know, well, came from Morocco, but then moved to Israel. I want people to be safe there. I want Jews to be safe there. I want Muslims and Christians. I want everybody to be safe there, atheists to be safe there. I think the kind of tone I take is, and I'll recommend that he's probably a left winger, but he's not one of those virulent, you know, radical left wingers, I don't think. I would recommend that people look on YouTube. He's got books too, but if you don't want to read it, you can, and I really like watching him. Avi Shlaim, his name is. S-H-L-A-I-M. In Hebrew, it's probably pronounced Shoim, but he lives in Britain. Now, he was born in Baghdad, moved to Israel as a child. He was born in like 1945, moved to Israel as a child. And then I think at age 18, went to England for education, university, and then ended up teaching in Oxford. Now he's retired. One point that he makes that gets totally forgotten is that he was born in Baghdad. He said, that's kind of strange, 45, born in Baghdad. There's a very old Jewish community. There was a very old Jewish community in Iraq, as well as other Arab countries that lived for many, many, many generations. I mean, it went back to the Babylonian exile, because that's what we call Iraq, Babylonia. Went back many generations, lived side by side with Arab Muslims and Arab Christians, and they were Arabs. You know, when we often hear two groups listed in the context of this conversation, Jews and Arabs. And it should immediately occur to people that that's not parallel. Jews, Jewish, that's religion. Arab, not religion, right? You can be Christian, you can be Muslim, you can be atheist, totally secular. You can be, I don't know, you can be a Buddhist, whatever. So how is that not parallel? And Schlein says, you know, they forget something. Arab Jew. He and his family and a whole lot of other families were Arab. They were really Arab and Jewish. They were Arab Jews. They ate Arab food. They spoke Arabic daily. They lived with other Arabs of other religions as neighbors, as good neighbors, you know, bringing, can I borrow a cup of sugar? You know, typical neighbors, friendly neighbors. And they only left because of nationalism, both the rise of Arab nationalism, but also Zionism. And of course, I don't know how many people know this. I talk about it in my book, and he talks about it. There was underground Zionist activity. After Israel was established, like beginning in 48 or so, underground activity in Baghdad, setting off bombs to scare Jews, to make them think the Arabs don't want you here. And they set off like four different bombs. He documents in his book, he has a new memoir. It's called Three Worlds, Memoir of an Arab Jew. I recommend it, or just find him speaking about it or being interviewed on YouTube. He's a wonderful guy. He's an old guy, you know, he's retired now. And he's written a whole bunch of other books on this. I think that's important to keep in mind. When he used to ask his mother, what's Zionism? Because they weren't Zionists. What's Zionism? She would say, that's an Ashkenazi thing. The Ashkenazis were the European Jews. The Arab Jews had a totally different experience. They didn't have a Hitler. They didn't have the pogroms. I think there was one bad incident in 1940 in Iraq. It was totally the exception. And again, it was nationalism, and there was, you know, Zionism was going on by then. And so that's, but he always says it's both. It was Arab nationalism and Jewish nationalism. He never says it was just one or just the other. I think that gives some perspective to the whole thing. I think a lot of American Jews and sympathizers of American Jews are so Eurocentric that they don't know anything but that. And I think Schlein broadens our whole view of that area of the world and what we might do today. I mean, he doesn't have a solution. He may be for one single democratic state. He's not a libertarian. But, you know, one free, secular, and I realize that would be risky, but anything today would be risky. I mean, the status quo is risky. So I don't know. I don't know what to do. I'm glad no one's calling on me, you know, appointing me Secretary of Solving the Middle East Crisis.
I mean, I think there are some problems that are intractable. When I said earlier that being a libertarian means you have all the answers to things, what I mean is I know what the first step is in a lot of cases, but there are nevertheless some social problems that do seem to defy any simple solution. Like I've given the example of being in Los Angeles in recent years and strolling around some parts of the city at night, and I just encounter so many lost souls there. I know that there are some policies we could implement, which pretty much involve just eliminating existing policies that might help the situation, but it's not going to solve everything. We've never said that it would. But yet, as you say, I know what not to do. I know what would make it worse. I know making people, you know, unemployable makes things worse. I know all kinds of things I can say no to. So just because a building is on fire, but I don't know how to rebuild it or build another building, doesn't mean I'm not going to still shout fire.
Yeah. No, I agree with that. And, I was going to say something, you know, the first part of your remarks, but slipped away. It's too bad because I thought it was a good point. I know what I was going to say, and this is purely personal. This is how I comfort myself. I kind of mentioned this early on. It only comforts me, or maybe if I'm talking to somebody, so it's not much, it doesn't help solve the problem. I go back and think of the early Jewish anti-Zionists, because they'd be thinking that they said at the time, in effect, these are my words, this isn't going to end well. This political movement, with its arrogant attitude toward the people who are there, the Arab, namely the Arabs, and you're shoving them aside, kicking them off land they've worked for generations and lived for generations, this is not going to end well. That's essentially what they were saying. And I think back to them and say, what would they be saying now? Or if they're looking down, I'm sure they're not going to laugh and say, I told you so, but it might be hard not to say, I told you so. And it breaks my heart. It really does. I'm sad on both sides. I don't want to see Jewish Israelis suffer at all. And I don't want to see the Palestinians. They've suffered horribly. But of course, they're not suffering as much as the American Jewish student on the college campus. I mean, I'm being sarcastic.
Of course.
You would think those Gazans shouldn't be talking about suffering. They don't know suffering until they lived as a Jewish person in 2024 America. That's the attitude you see. To get back to my earlier point about cynicism, that's what their people are saying here. And that's obscene. I think that's obscene.
I think it's going to be, you know, I know you say you don't fall on either left or right, but we can be interested spectators in what's happening. And it is interesting to see what this is doing on the left, because I think somehow the left has existed in an uneasy coexistence of semi-compatible, semi-incompatible factions for a while. But this issue has always been bubbling beneath the surface, threatening to blow it apart. Yeah. And I think this is the biggest strain the left has been under as a result of this issue, certainly that I've ever seen.
Yeah, and you know, I think we exchanged a little email on this. I watched parts, you know, excerpts of those hearings in the House where they called university presidents. The latest one was from Columbia, right? Before Elise Stefanik, and who are truly horrible people. But like you, I'm not on the president's side either. I mean, I kind of sympathize with how they were used, and they were simply used for television. You mean to say if someone says kill the Jews, that's not a violation of your school? Well, who said kill the Jews? The one incident was apparently a Jewish person said kill the Jews, because that was reported in the Daily Beast. It was a false flyer. So I can't stand those people on the dais who were raised up, the Congress critters. But I don't have much sympathy for those presidents either, because, and I agree with, to this extent, I agree with what, well, some people are saying, not with the conservatives, actually, what the left is saying. The right, if those terms really have any meaning, but the right, you know, used to cackle about the snowflakes, right? The people that couldn't take a speaker, you know, Charles Murray coming on campus, or, you know, someone who didn't buy their view of woke racism. And to that extent, they were right. If your feelings are hurt, that's not a reason to exclude get a speaker, you know, kicked out, or them, or like attack them physically. You know, people have been attacked, or Charles Murray have been attacked. But now all of a sudden, the right is concerned about feelings, right? The Jewish feelings. I feel danger. Well, is there actually danger? I don't care if there's really danger. I feel in danger. Well, the right used to make fun of that. Now they've adopted it. So it's true. There's a double standard on both sides. You know, when you think that there's a double standard, you need to do two things. Number one, make sure there really is a double standard. Look into it. Number two, figure out which standard is the right one. People like to just leave it at, hey, that's a double standard. Yeah, but which is the right double standard? I side with free speech, and basically because I'm a libertarian, I believe in individual rights. So that means free speech, you know, obviously not on other people's property. It's all those kinds of caveats. But there is hypocrisy, and it is on both the left and right, however we define those words.
And it reminds you of something that's not, unfortunately, very good news, which is that when push comes to shove, not a lot of people really believe in principles or free speech. They really don't. They use it as a bludgeon to hurt the other side with. But yeah. Whose ox is being gored? And then you find out where they stand.
Yeah, I think we're really seeing that. I mean, it's very flagrant now with these conservatives, these congressional conservatives, but other people, Dennis Prager, you know, all of a sudden now, a person's feelings, purely subjective experience counts. They used to make fun of lived experience. You know how the left will talk about, well, my lived experience is what counts. They would cackle at that. Now, all of a sudden, oh, what about the students that feel unsafe because somebody's shouting chanting freedom for Palestine? We're using the Likud phrase, you know, from the river to the sea. It's an old Likud phrase. They forget that. So I agree with you. You'd think they would be a little smarter and say, well, no, I better not make that argument because I'm going to criticize that argument tomorrow. So probably.
Yeah, right.
Today. They think there's no memory. In the age of the internet, it's a really bad time to think there's no memory, because it's going to live forever and people are going to be able to watch it on YouTube or somewhere else for 100 years or more.
Well, apart from Coming to Palestine, your book, where do people read what Sheldon Richman has to say?
Well, everything I write, just about everything, is at the Libertarian Institute, and that's just libertarianinstitute.org, O-R-G. That's kind of mirrored on my own blog, which I've had. Next year will be 20 years old, Free Association, which is sheldonfreeassociation.blogspot.com. So it's a Blogspot blogger. And then I've been putting that too on a Substack. So if it's easier to search for me on Substack, and you'll remember the URLs I've just given you, you can find it there. So, and it's mainly political stuff. I've been writing a weekly column for different organizations for a long time under the title TGIF, which stands for, thank goodness, that's what I'm playing off of. The goal is freedom, but it comes out on Friday. So of course, I guess this is Friday, but the goal is freedom. And so I'm there every Friday at the Libertarian Institute. And that's pretty much where you can find me. The books are on Amazon, both Kindle, softback. Read and enjoy.
Very good. Well, I'm very happy to sit on the board of the Libertarian Institute. I appreciate what it does. And I will say, I guess in wrapping up, that I appreciate our conversation today. You have informed many and enraged others.
I hope so.
And I will find out in my email inbox in the next few days who's who. And, thanks again, Sheldon.
My pleasure, anytime.
And thank you, ladies and gentlemen.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit TomWoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at Podsworth.com.